I'm Jonathan Green. This is Lost and Found, and this week, a mind journey to Tokyo.
2番線, ドアが閉まります. ご注意ください.
お待たせいたしました. Tokyo Metro, 丸の内線をご利用いただきまして、ありがとうございます.
Colin Bissett.
We're going to see a show at Tokyo International Forum. Start from Tokyo's main station, a grand red brick terminus built in 1914 with pillars and columns that wouldn't look out of place in London. It deals with 3,000 train departures a day, including the Shinkansen bullet trains, which glide so effortlessly into the station. You'll have to go to Osaka if you want to catch the Hello Kitty-themed version, though. Follow the signs out into the Marunouchi district and turn left. You'll notice the sharp prow of a glass and steel building at the end of the street. That's the Forum, and its pièce de résistance is an astonishing lobby known as the Glass Hall. It's an incredible sight and looks even better at night. A huge 228-metre truss tops the seven-storey structure and bulges down like the underside of a boat, although to my eye it feels like walking inside a Zeppelin airship or even the belly of a whale. Ramps lead up to the different levels, where angled metal and glass bridges take you to one of the four auditoria, which house everything from musicals to trade shows. It's a clear demonstration of the synergy between architectural vision and engineering know-how, and testimony to the fact that architecture is all about the manipulation of space. Don't take the lift in this building. This is a place of perambulation. And don't miss the tranquil courtyard garden outside, shielded from the noise and clamour of the city beyond. The Forum was designed in 1996 by Rafael Vignoli, a Uruguayan architect based in America, and yet this is a very Japanese structure, as light as a paper lantern, and a pavilion that will quietly thrill you.
Tokyo is too close up to see sometimes. There are no distances, and everything is above your head. Dentists, kindergartens, dance studios, even the roads and walkways are up on murky stilts, an evil twin Venice, with all the water drained away. David Mitchell.
2番線, ドアが閉まります. ご注意ください.
お待たせいたしました. 東京メトロ.
Off to the heart of Japanese street style, a square mile of wild fashion invention, a moment in time, Harajuku. Dr. Daphne Mahajavapasaran is a fashion lecturer at RMIT School of Fashion and Textiles. Daphne, welcome.
Thank you.
Take us to this place.
Well, first you'd have to get onto a plane, get yourself to Tokyo, get onto the Yamanote Line, and get out at Harajuku Station. And when you get out of the station, you're there. It's all there in front of you.
It confronts you. People are wild and exciting.
Gaggles of people, crowds, shops, noise, color, and fashion.
If we go back a little bit, if we go back into the 90s, I'm guessing, there was a real thing happening, a real street style that emerged.
I think actually to talk about Harajuku, you kind of have to go back even further. You'd have to go back to post-war Japan. So right after the war, there's a big park in Harajuku called Yoyogi Park, which is really well known now. That park used to be an American army base called Washington Heights. And basically, you'd have these American soldiers and their families living there together. And so what happened was that became kind of an undesirable place for Japanese people to go. And what happens when general culture, general population doesn't want to go to a place is young people tend to go there.
Of course.
The rent is cheap. You have things like studios popping up and, you know, artists move in and they get these old apartments and they make their own culture.
And the thing that happens, is it not, is one of the main streets, one of the big areas there is a pedestrian zone. It's people on their feet showing off.
One of the old apartment buildings that was there was called Dojunkai, and that apartment building is on this main street called Omotesando, which they would shut off. and have this kind of pedestrian paradise that would, and so on the weekends people would come in and hang out and have little craft fairs and things. And with one of these apartment buildings was kind of the center of Harajuku culture. And I don't know if you're familiar with the fashion brand Comme des Garçons.
I am. Contain your surprise.
I was testing you, I guess. They're pretty well known and pretty influential. She, Reika Okubo, actually started her brand in those apartment buildings on Omotesando in Harajuku. And that was back when, you know, the rent was cheap and when it was still...
It's a happy accident, really.
It absolutely was. Now, that apartment building has been torn down. Tadao Ando, famous Japanese architect, has built Omotesando Hills, which is this beautiful, striking, you know, brutalist concrete luxury department store right on the spot where it used to stand.
And the pedestrian paradise is full of cars.
And the pedestrian paradise is full of cars. Yeah, luxury cars.
Comme des Garçons is a certain kind of look, and it's dark and... grapey.
But if you look at Comme des Garçons, you see a lot of DIY elements, a lot of hand stitching,
okay.
A lot of rebellious going against, you know, how clothing is supposed to be constructed, what fashion is supposed to be, you know, in terms of the Parisian kind of idea of couture and fashion.
But the Harajuku street style is a thing apart from that.
It's hard to say, though, because the Harajuku street style now is very, very different from what it was then in the 90s. And that world of Harajuku is very different now. So gentrification has happened. There are a lot of bigger brands now. The income of the general consumer has gone down since the 90s as well. So there's less... consumers are now tending to buy fast fashion. So Uniqlo, yeah. Zara, H&M, yeah. Topshop. So that's a little bit more popular now than the smaller brands, which might have a higher cost.
But in the 80s, 90s, this is one of the centres of a genuine street style. It's such a rare thing. I mean, you think Chelsea in London in the late 70s,
yeah.
is another example. But
absolutely.
Here in Tokyo, we have this development of something quite unique.
There were things that weren't being presented on the catwalk anywhere in the world. They only existed there. And I think they only existed because people were directly trading information with each other on the street in that moment, in that place.
It's that amazing moments in fashion when the things that people are wearing are truly their own invention. It's not from somewhere else. It's not something made.
Yeah, and there was a really great kind of mix of East and West, too, that was happening. They were, I think, because a lot of the youths at the time were rediscovering the kimono, so rediscovering Japanese prints, rediscovering the traditional Japanese textiles and clothing, because they were going to recycle shops. They were going to secondhand stores, or op shops, as you call them. Because they were going to these op shops, they were finding all these beautiful kimono, and they were wearing them in ways that people had never worn before.
And sad to say, it's a path that just ultimately leads to Uniqlo.
Don't all roads lead to Uniqlo.
Daphne, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Japan's most famous 20th century architect is surely Kenzo Tange. There are plenty of examples of his work in Tokyo, including the National Gymnasium he designed for the Tokyo Olympics in 1964, whose roof is suspended from tall masts so that it twists and swirls as elegantly as a Japanese fan. But I think St. Mary's Cathedral, completed at the same time, is just as beautiful. Take the metro out to the Edogawabashi station, cross the Kanda River, and walk up the hill into the quieter Bunkyo neighbourhood. The cathedral is set back from the busy road, guarded by low buildings of finely shaped concrete and glass. A slender bell tower rises up to spike the sky. The cathedral itself is covered in ribbed stainless steel, which will dazzle you on a sunny day. There's a touch of the Sydney Opera House in the way its extraordinary shape rises up from the blocky concrete buildings around it. It's a tent hoiked over a cruciform shape, highest at the apse, and glazed along the top to draw light down into the interior. You might expect the interior to have the same light and filmy quality as the outside, but it's a sombre and grand space, lined in raw concrete. Being a Catholic cathedral, it has the usual religious statues dotted around, though there's a font made from a cut and polished boulder, which feels just right. It's a space made for the sound of singing voices, and naturally Kenzo Tange's own funeral was held here in 2005, when he died at the age of 91. Its tent shape was inspired by the Philips Pavilion that Le Corbusier designed for the Brussels Expo of 1958. But this cathedral is more than a nod to another building. It's Tange at the height of his powers, merging his love of technology and industrial materials with the Japanese craft and delicacy seen in traditional buildings. A spiritual masterpiece.
Colin Bissett. I'm Jonathan Green. This is Lost and Found this week, travelling via the mind to Tokyo. Couldn't really say I belong to Tokyo and its coffee shops, but I'd never felt this loneliness there. I could drink my coffee, read my book, pass the time of day without any special thought, all because I was part of the regular scenery. Here I had no ties to anyone. Fact is, I'd come to reclaim myself. Haruki Murakami. I feel a need for greenery. I feel a need for a garden. My guide, Dr. Aichi Tasaki, he's an author, artist. He's a visiting professor at Belgrade University. Aichi, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Take me to a Tokyo garden.
Tokyo's a kind of unusual green city already compared to Osaka. If you got Meiji shrines and a lot of the secret gardens and public gardens, there's a lot of greenery there. Rikugien is a quite good kind of garden we should talk about.
This is a remarkable garden because it's all about the rules of poetry.
Yeah, the Riku means six, you know. There are six different types of poetry. Yanagisawa Yoshiyasu, he was the founder of the garden, and he made, designed everything of the garden around the early 18th centuries. Uh-huh. And he made the garden based on his kind of habit of making poetry, you know.
What are those rules, and how are they then manifest in a garden?
You know, the Japanese culture, they're based on the poetry. Even lovers, they exchange their letters only through the waka and the poetry. Mm-hmm. So poetry is a very important means for communications and also history of poetry culture. So Yanagisawa Yoshiyasu really appreciate the history of Japanese poetry culture. And based on poetry kind of spirit, he wanted to build the garden. And also the Japanese poetry in relation to nature, appreciation with the moon. So the moons reflect on the surface of a lake. They appreciate. For example, famous Japanese garden in Kyoto, Katsura Remote Palace, the garden, only building built for the appreciation of the moon.
It's a beautiful
and
thought.
And poetry making, you know, like a party coming with the musicians.
So in this garden, 88 scenes from famous poems.
88 is very important number for Buddhism and the lucky number. And also the, not necessarily poetry, the also the stones allocated in Rikugien used to be 88 stones. And now only 32 stones remain because of the earthquake, a lot of stuff kind of going on. The stones are very important for the Japanese garden making. 20th century, there's a famous Japanese garden-making grammar called Sakuteki, the how to make a garden. The first line was Sakuteki, the how to erect a stone, starting point. But how can you find the first stone? It's a long, long story.
So choosing that first stone, and then there is a great mystery, I suspect, in that.
Yes.
Rakugien is a walking garden, a place to stroll between these.
Yeah, strolling, a big strolling garden in the Rikugien, yes. And to erect the first stone, they have to make a good choice of a first stone. They walked around mountains and near the coastal areas to find the independent stone. the stone has to be independent in the nature situation as well. If the stones are leaning toward the other stones or leaning toward the trees, it's not good, it's the best choice. So self-standing stone in the nature as well, they have to make choice first.
I'm impressed by so much in Japanese culture of its certainty, its sense of correctness.
Yeah, because the Japanese observation, the object itself is quite deep and spiritual. They believe that each spirit living in each object. So the stone, self-standing stone, already has an independent spirit and strong, you know, kind of protection by itself.
Rikugien, the Garden of Six Poems, a beautiful part of Tokyo. Thank you, Aichi.
Okay.
Dr. Aichi Tasaki. Living right in the heart of Tokyo itself is quite like living in the mountains. In the midst of so many people, one hardly sees anyone. Yuko Tsushima.
Tokyo Metro, Ginza-sen wo goriyou itadakimashite, arigatou gozaimasu. Kono densha wa...
Ueno Park is the cultural precinct of Tokyo, a gift to the city in 1924, when the soon-to-be emperor, Hirohito, married. Cross the street from the busy station and you're thrust into leafy parkland that's a melting pot of 20th century architecture. Here you'll find the Museum of Western Art, a large concrete box slung up on slim columns with a sculptural staircase protruding from its pebbled facade. It's Le Corbusier's only building in the Far East, built in 1957, and it's curiously linked to other buildings nearby. Two are by the architect Kunio Maekawa, who worked for Le Corbusier in Paris in 1928, unusual for the time. The Bunker Kaikan of 1961 is a venue for dance and opera with an excellent music library. Its use of concrete and linear shape rising above a row of columns is a clear indication of Le Corbusier's influence. Just as Maekawa was apprenticed to Le Corbusier, Kenzo Tange was apprenticed to Maekawa in 1938, showing how the influence of one great architect, Le Corbusier, filters down through successive generations of architects. It's why so many of the concrete buildings of modern Japan have a Corbusian look to them. But walk further into the park and you'll find umpteen other buildings, including the Pale Brick National Museum of Nature and Science, built in 1931, with a life-size model outside of a blue whale diving down. It looks very British and shows how Western architecture was seen as the most appropriate guise for a serious museum. And yet, a few years later, in 1938, the Tokyo National Museum, just opposite, has a distinctive Japanese look, with a traditional tiled roof that echoes those of the nearby 17th century Toshugo Shrine with its wooden pagoda. It shows why Ueno, with its myriad buildings and lovely treescape, is an essential stop and an architectural highlight in a city filled with contrasts, cultural to its core.
Colin Bissett. Think Japan, think seafood. Think seafood, think tuna. Nori Koizumi is marketing manager at Oceania Seafoods. He will take us to market. And Daisuke Miyake is a chef at Shinoki Restaurant in Melbourne. He will take us to the tuna.
So here in front of us is 50 kilos of tuna, this beautiful, shining gunmetal fish. Tail has been taken off. The tail is discarded.
So tell me what we're going to do.
So I'm going to fillet the tuna, and I chopped off the heads first. And using knife and also...
There's a saw.
Some parts, the bones are very hard.
Where is this tuna from?
From the Queensland.
So that tail, that'll give you a sense of the quality through the rest of the fish.
Yes, it's like the everything coming from the tail part towards to the head, the meat. So we'll understand the quality from the tail part and also the container fatness.
Can you take the tail off before you buy the fish?
We cut like a bit, like 1 centimeter or something.
Just to see. Here goes the head.
It's the big moment. And the two hands here to hold the fish, and the saw is going in. There's a good cut there, the back of the head behind the eye, and a bit more sawing. The head is detached.
And now, take off the jaw, the skull.
The fin?
The fin, yes.
Taking off that side fin with a large section, leaving a beveled edge to the rest of the carcass of the fish.
Actually, when we fillet the tuna, so we like take off the five parts, like shoulder meat, and the belly side, and the bones, and one more shoulder, and one more belly. Five parts.
An incision now from right at the base of the tail along the top line of the fish. Past the dorsal fin. You can see a thin sort of subcutaneous membrane over the muscle of the meat of the fish, just underneath the dark gunmetal of its outside skin. Big deep cut now above the top of the spine. And now a cut down the side wall of the body, halfway through the flank of the fish. The flesh inside is dark and bloody, but marbled from the fat that we saw in the tail. Big fillet is almost done now, almost ready to be removed, and it's nigh on just under a meter in length, and it's a serious piece of flesh. And it's beautifully done. You can see the thin white of the ribs of the fish now exposed after that fillet's removed.
Like after fillet on the bone, actually there's not a lot of meat, but still meat on it. So this meat doesn't have sinew. The best part of the tuna, actually.
It's being scraped off with a spoon,
because between the bone and the bone, that has like a 2 centimeter, and actually lots of meat in there.
So this is soft flesh coming between the ribs of the fish, left over from the filleting, and yes, soft enough to be scraped out.
And we call this meat nakaochi in Japanese. Nakaochi, naka means the middle, and ochi means like a offcut. So we call this one nakaochi, like a middle offcut. Very good part.
The markets in Tokyo, amazingly busy place with an amazing amount of fish.
Yes, there's 480 different fish in the Tsukiji market, and also the market had the vegetable market as well. So both is combined, everything is there.
You must need to know your way around.
Actually, the Tsukiji market has just moved from the old place to the new place. Mm-hmm. Now we call it Toyosu market at the moment.
There must be nothing like it anywhere else in the world.
Not really. But the funny things is the once you go to Tsukiji Toyosu market, you never feel like, oh, the fish smell very dirty. Never happen. It's the fish always there is everything fresh, so you don't feel like any smelly, those kind of things.
So the smell in the air is, it must be just that fresh, salty sea smell, not that sort of faint fishy smell you get in other markets.
Yeah, more human smell there. That's fighting each other, you know, saying, oh, yeah, come on, bye.
Is there much competition for the best fish?
Oh, yes, because a robot chef is very high skilled technical chef there. So that's why they worry about the price, but also they are more worried about the quality.
And the quality over the years has stayed high, has stayed good?
It's up the weather, unfortunately, because all the fish is catching by the boat. If very windy, they can go out. But most likely, Tsukiji is one of the as you know, they want the biggest place in the world. The reason is all the fish from over the world is coming to Tsukiji market. That it makes the Tsukiji market is the biggest market in the world.
You've been listening to Lost and Found. This week on Tokyo. You heard from Dr. Daphne Mahajavipassaran, fashion lecturer at RMIT, Nori Koizumi of Oceania Seafoods and Daisuke Miyake, tuna loiner and chef, Dr. Aichi Tasaki, artist and author, and Blueprint's constant companion in the built environment, Colin Bissett. Producers are Mira Adligillis, Buffy Gorilla and Lisa DeVissi. Technical production by Tim Simons and Ari Gross. I'm Jonathan Green.